and those who are connected with it. Perhaps the bad guys are not all black, just as the heroes are not entirely all white. In researching his history, I did not limit myself to the two-year period he had in connection with the Utah history. I found a man who was not entirely the tyrant he has been made out to be, a man who loved animals, children, his country, a man who loved the strategy of playing chess, a man who didn't exact the severest penalties on errant soldiers or his slave who he determined had stolen thousands of dollars from him. In fact, in those days, of course, you could do almost anything you wanted to your own slaves. And after he caught this slave of his, had stolen literally thousands of dollars from him, he did sell him, but he did not exact a physical punishment or kill him, literally, which he could have done in those days. He was a man who lived by a code of honor. Certainly, there are positions he took that I do not agree with. Those stem principally from the region of the country that he was raised in, which drew his loyalty to the slavery issue. By reading some of his communications, I have found him to be a rather sympathetic person with many admirable traits and attributes. He had a particularly tender heart towards his family members. Thus, I would like to introduce General Johnston and bring him back here to Pasadena. Albert Sidney Johnston came from a very distinguished family. His father, John Johnston, a physician, was married three times. By his first wife, he had three sons. She died at approximately 30 years of age, the first wife. Their eldest son, Josiah Stoddard, had graduated from law school in Kentucky. He had fought in the War of 1812, after which he took up the occupation of judge. Later, he was elected to the U.S. Congress and then to the U.S. Senate. His political career was cut short as he was killed in an explosion on a steamship traveling at the Red River in Louisiana. So here we can demonstrate some of the connections that Albert Sidney Johnston's family had. We had a U.S. senator that was a member of his immediate family. So this was not just some innocuous army soldier that was going amok coming to Utah. The other two sons by the first wife, Mary Stoddard, both participated as combatants in the Mexican War of Independence. Darius and Oramel were captured by the Spanish forces. The former earned a law degree, the latter a medical degree. Unfortunately, both died as young men due to their experience as prisoners of war. So again, we can see that his brothers were educated men, that they tended to be in the medical or the legal professions. Albert Sidney Johnston's widow father next married Abigail Harris in 1794 in Kentucky. There were eight children born through this union. Sidney, or Sid as he was called, was their fifth child. Their eldest child, John Harrison Johnston, earned a law degree and served as a district and parish judge of Louisiana and was elected to the state legislature. His next two brothers, Alfred and Lucius, both died in their early 20s in 1819. The following two children were sisters Anna Maria and Clarissa. The latter never married. Albert Sidney was born on February 2, 1803, in Washington, Kentucky. He was followed by sisters Eliza and Abigail. The latter died shortly after her birth. His mother died from complications of that last birth in 1806, just months preceding Abigail's death. Thus, Albert was deprived of the affections of his mother as a young infant. His twice-widowed father then remarried a widow, Mrs. Byers, who helped raise the Johnston siblings. Albert Sidney elected not to follow the career choices of law or medicine as had his older brothers and many of his other relatives. Instead, he decided to pursue a military education, possibly being influenced by hearing the tales of military exploits of his half-brothers. One can well imagine a young boy as he's growing up and hearing his older siblings detailing their adventures in the military. Since his eldest half-brother was a congressman and helped him secure an appointment to the West Point Academy for Albert, he immediately demonstrated a proclivity for military regimentation and discipline. He was very accomplished in his courses and would have been second in his graduating class of 1826, but fell to eighth highest in the class of 41 when he incorrectly answered several questions on his final. So he was considered a very esteemed cadet at the West Point. While at the academy, he acquired the friendship of Jefferson Davis, who was his junior, and who took on an almost hero worship of the upperclassmen. Due to his superior class ranking, he was tendered a plum appointment to be the aide-de-camp of General Winfield Scott. Since this was essentially a desk job, he declined the offer so he could be where the action was, that initially being the Black Hawk War. So already the military was recognizing Albert Sidney Johnston as a prime candidate officer for appointments. He fought in the Mexican War under General Zachary Taylor, who is quoted as stating that Johnston was the finest soldier he ever commanded. So again, a very prominent soldier that we give great respect to, and he accorded this type of acknowledgement of Johnston's military ability. Old Hickory would one day become the father-in-law of Jefferson Davis, which is very interesting, the future president of the Confederacy. Taylor would precede that event, of course, himself by becoming the United States president. Johnston returned from this campaign in Mexico to join his wife, Henrietta Preston, who he had married in 1829 in Kentucky. She was the eldest of nine children born to William Preston II and Caroline Hancock. Her brother, William Preston III, would distinguish himself by serving in the U.S. Congress from Kentucky. William Preston III was also appointed as an ambassador to Spain and would become a major general in the Confederacy during the Civil War. Henrietta's only other brother died as a teenager. Albert Sidney and Henrietta were first blessed with a son in 1831, who was named after his father, William Preston. Willie, as he was known, initially went to a military institute, but later attended Yale University, and there earned a law degree at the University of Louisville. He would follow a law career. Later, he became the first president of Louisiana State University, LSU, and later the president of Tulane University. During the Civil War, he served as a general in the Confederacy. So again, we're seeing this connection of being very educated family and very accomplished in their achievements. The family was relocated to the Jefferson Barracks in Missouri while Albert Sidney served in his various military capacities. His wife would suffer medical problems and depression and desired that her husband resign his military post. This was a most difficult request as the military was in Albert's blood. Initially, he resisted her entreaties. They were then blessed with a daughter, Henrietta Preston. She was followed by a sister, Maria Preston, who would later die before 1 year of age. The illness of her daughter added to his wife's despondency, and Albert Sidney acquiesced to his wife's request in 1834, submitted his resignation from the military, and acquired a plantation. Her health continued to decline, and she expired from tuberculosis in 1835, 1 year later, leaving Albert Sidney with his two surviving youngsters. So here was a man who had been a military leader, and now he had two small children, a plantation that he really didn't want to run, and he felt like a fish out of water. He then wanted to join the military esprit de corps, was, of course, coursing through his veins, and so he left his two children with his in-laws and headed to Texas, where a republic was being formed and General Santa Anna was making Texans and Americans remember the Alamo. He became a popular hero figure in Texas. However, the appointment for command did not come without conflict for Albert Sidney Johnston. He was given command over a General Felix Houston, whose ego would not accept a subordinate role. Thus, he formally challenged Johnston to a duel. In the era of chivalry, Albert Sidney cordially responded that he would give him satisfaction. And I read the actual response, and it amazes me in those days how they dealt with this deal of chivalry and, you know, your honor and so forth. And so he accorded him this opportunity to have a duel because he felt slighted that he wasn't the senior commanding officer. So the next day, they met out on the field of honor where each exchanged six shots apiece. the last striking Johnson in the hip. Initially, they thought it would prove fatal, but he recovered, and General Houston would dutifully serve under his new commander, having preserved his honor. So they just went on just as if nothing ever happened after this duel, because now his honor had been satisfied in front of all the men that he had been accorded this opportunity to duel. Later, Albert Sidney would be appointed Secretary of War for the Texas Republic by Sam Houston. A decade later, he would be appointed the paymaster of the U.S. Army by newly elected President Zachary Taylor, his former military superior in the Mexican War. His military service under General Winfred Scott would produce further favorable evaluations as to his military prowess. He returned from military service to visit his two motherless children. His letters demonstrate a great love of his two children, and they really are very tender letters that you read that he wrote to his children while he was away from them performing military services. While there, he struck up a friendship with Elizabeth Griffin, who was 21 years younger than the distinguished general. She was a first cousin of his first wife, her mother, Mary Hancock, being the sister of Henrietta's mother, Caroline Hancock. Julia Hancock, another of their sisters, married William Clark. He is the Clark who led the Lewis and Clark expedition. So again, you just see how the different families within the structure of America, prominent families tended to marry and intermarry with one another and maintain their relationships. One of Elizabeth Griffin's brothers, George, died as an officer in the Florida War. Another of her brothers, William, was an officer in the Navy. Elizabeth's eldest brother, John Strother Griffin, would have a distinguished military career also. He served as an officer physician in the U.S. Army, and he accompanied Kit Carson and General Kearney to California during the war with Mexico. He was in attendance at the Battle of San Pascual in San Diego County in 1846. So he administered, and this was the only battle in the war for California's independence where there was really a battle and some soldiers were lost, and he, of course, administered to those that were survivors that were wounded. He would resign his commission in Los Angeles in 1854. He was the second Angelo physician to arrive in the city of Los Angeles, or the City of Angels. He would become the president of the Los Angeles Medical Association and superintendent of the schools of Los Angeles. He would become a part owner of the water company that serviced Los Angeles for nearly 50 years, and he was known as the father of East Los Angeles and would donate land that would become the site of the University of Southern California. So her brother, John Strother Griffin, was very prominent in the Los Angeles early history. John Griffin also served on various boards of directors of businesses in Los Angeles, and he became very wealthy in his various business endeavors. He was one of the very first property owners in what is now known as Pasadena and Altadena, owning over 14,000 acres in this area. He maintained strong Southern sympathies during the Civil War and was one of the prominent Los Angelinos in that regard, as Southern California was a strong Confederacy stronghold. And it's very interesting in studying California history because we've, over the years, heard about separating Northern California from Southern California. Well, part of that whole issue related back to the Civil War days, in that Southern California was very strongly associated with Southerners, and their sympathies lied with the South. And it was the Northerners in Northern California who resisted separating the state because they didn't want this with the Civil War breaking out. John Griffin would marry Louisa Hayes, the first female teacher of Los Angeles. Her brother, Benjamin Ignatius Hayes, was the first American to open a law office in Los Angeles. He was elected as the Los Angeles County Attorney. In fact, he was the first elected officer of that position, and later as a judge in the Southern District of California. And he maintained a diary during his lifetime that is now in the Huntington Library. And he is prominently known because of his keeping of a diary and the histories of the early Los Angeles development, that he was named as the first president of the Los Angeles Historical Association. And, of course, as a judge, He had the privilege, or the opportunity at least, of condemning many a man to the neck stretcher, and he did sentence many men to be hung. He also maintained his strong Confederate associations and sentiments along with his John Griffin. Louisa Hayes Griffin had a sister who married Cyrus Burdick, who was a descendant from a Mormon family. Louisa Hayes also had a sister, Helena Josephine, who would marry a Benjamin Smith Eaton Sr., who would, after which, nearby Eaton Canyon at the base of Mount Wilson is named. And the Eatons, Judge Eaton, was again accorded one of the first residences of Pasadena and helped develop the subdivision of Pasadena. And their properties go way back. I will get back to them further later on in this presentation. But for right now, I'll get back to Albert Sidney Johnson's courtship of Elizabeth Griffin. They were married on October 3rd, 1843 in Kentucky. In 6 months, they were the parents of Albert Sidney Johnston, Jr. He was born in Galveston, Texas, where the general was serving. Albert Jr.'s life would tragically end in San Pedro Bay on April 27, 1863, with the explosion of a steamship Ada Hancock. This particular steamship was owned by Phineas Banning, and I've done some very interesting research on that explosion. There was about 24 individuals who were killed, and about 24 individuals that survived that explosion, including Phineas Banning. His sons survived, and of course his sons eventually bought Catalina Island, who later then sold it on to the Wrigley family. Also, Wilson, after which Mount Wilson is named, was on the ship, and he survived. So these were the very prominent Los Angeles citizens of the day. Included among the fatalities of this explosion were two Mormon missionaries who were heading for the Solomon Islands, and they lost their lives in this explosion. And a very interesting side story to that issue is that, of course, they were both married men, and one of them, Kimball was his last name, his wife was the lady that had the first meeting of the Relief Society in her house in Nauvoo. And she became very prominent in Utah history in that she became the president of the women's suffragette movement. And there are pictures of her with all the prominent suffragette ladies of the era, including our famous one that had her engraving of the dollar, Susan B. Anthony. But his widow is just an incredible lady to read her history. Another interesting story on that is that when they had their first child, her husband was not a member of the church. And so she went to her husband and she said, what do you think our son's worth? And he sort of casually said, well, I think he's worth about $1,000. And she says, fine, I'm donating my half to the church. In which case her husband then had to go to Joseph Smith and tell him the story. And so Joseph said, okay, what's your pleasure? You want me to pay you for the other half, or you want to pay me for your half? Which way do you want to work this? And so he actually worked out a deal with Joseph Smith and donated land, which is adjacent to the temple site in Nauvoo, to, quote, own the full ownership of his own son. Albert and Elizabeth's family grew with the addition of another son named Hancock McClung in 1845. He would become a business entrepreneur in Los Angeles also. And he also developed land all over the Los Angeles basin. He would also be a participant in donating land for the University of Southern California. So here this family are very strong contributors to helping establish the University of Southern California. He would one day marry Mary Alice Eaton, a daughter of Judge Benjamin Smith Eaton. There is a humorous account of Hancock Johnston that I'd like to relate. One day he was at a eating dinner with an Englishman at the Pico Hotel, which was the first major hotel in Los Angeles. And he suddenly pulled out his pistol and discharged it in the direction of the man's legs under the table, and then hoisted his six gun and put it in his holster. And this, of course, shocked his associate that was eating his dinner. and the startled associate was taken back and he inquired as to the purpose of this action. Hancock responded that he observed a cockroach climbing up the man's pants. Fortunately for his dining companion, his accuracy was excellent. The Johnston family would have three additional children, Mary, Charles, and an infant. Charles would be the only of the three to live to adulthood, and Albert Sidney called Mary Maggie in his correspondence. And of course, with losing these small children, that was a tragedy in his life. Elizabeth Griffin Johnston, who went by the name Eliza, like her husband's first wife, desired that her husband leave the military service and settle down to a plantation life. So these women all wanted him to become domesticated, but it wasn't in his blood. Although he accommodated her initially by acquiring another property, he felt ill-suited to this lifestyle. He longed for the outdoors where he could ride his horse and enjoy the comradeship of the soldiers in arms. His next call to duty occurred due to the Indian problems in Oklahoma. And taking leave of his family, he took responsibility of organizing and commanding a new regiment of soldiers to deal with the hostile Indians of the territory. It was while he was so engaged that he received his next set of orders that would draw him into Mormon history. He replaced General Harney and was ordered to march to the Utah Territory. President Buchanan believed that the Mormons under Brigham Young were in insurrection with the United States. The Mountain Meadow Massacre had occurred, and Brigham had stated that he forbid all forces of every description from coming into the territory under any pretense whatsoever. No person shall be allowed to pass or repass into or through or from this territory without a permit from the proper offices. They say their army is legal, and I say that such a statement is as false as hell. That's Brigham Young. Brigham was in defiance of the United States government. He had Lott Smith intercept the army supply wagons and destroy a substantial value of property. It is unfathomable to think that of such actions of defiance occurring today against our federal forces. Our military would treat such a provocation as they have reacted against the Taliban. If we were to have that happen today, we'd find a different result to occurring against the Mormons if we were to experience something like that. General Albert Sidney Johnston had not chosen to do battle with the Mormons. This was not his election to go against Utah, but he was ordered to do so. And the dedicated soldier, and he was going to fulfill what his orders were. And he would not turn back because he always wanted a good fight, and so he followed his orders. Due to the military's late start and supply harassments, his 2,000 soldiers were forced to spend the winter of 1858 and 1859 in the remnants of Fort Bridger, which the Mormons had burned to the ground. The army would have to endure reduced rations and minus 16 degree weather during that winter. You can well imagine experiencing without a good food supply and housing how miserable they are. I know when I was on my mission just tracking in the snow, I was miserable, and that would be a couple hours. Never in Mormon literature is we read about the winter, the handcart companies and their sufferings, and all sympathy is accorded to them, but never in Mormon literature is accorded a similar sentiment towards the U.S. Army facing similar potentially fatal inclement weather. We never give any sympathy to these soldiers that are out there in that type of conditions. One can appreciate Johnston's sentiments towards the Mormons as he and his men endured under such extreme hardships and conditions. Buchanan would appoint Alfred Cummings to be the new territorial governor. His arrival in the spring, along with Thomas L. Kane, would prevail on Johnston to allow them to attempt a peaceful resolution of the matters with Brigham. Because Johnston wanted to go down there and win some military honors, and the other individuals persuaded him that they had command of the situation and that he had to follow their orders. Fortunately, they did prevail, and he wasn't able to give the Mormons a real butt-whipping by going down and shooting a few of the Mormons. It is no doubt that he could have created serious damage had a military solution prevailed. As descendants of those early Mormon pioneers, we should be grateful civil heads prevail, because who knows if they had attacked and wiped out the Mormons, if we would have even existed. In accordance with negotiated stipulations, Johnston marched his soldiers through a deserted Salt Lake City and hence to a 60-mile distance, a two-day march, where he established Camp Floyd. This permitted Brigham the necessary time for warning his if the military were to make a move towards the capital. So I can understand Brigham Young wanting some distance between these soldiers. Also, as Brigham had predicted, this military entourage brought with it some very low life and unsavory people. There was gamblers, there was prostitution, and all sorts of things, and he didn't want this near the city of Salt Lake. Gamblers and prostitutes availed themselves, of course, of the servicemen's pay, a ready resource. The town of Fairfield soon became the second largest community in the territory. Main Street was graced by 17 hotel saloon brothels. With the exception of Mormon John Carson's Hotel, also a related party on this sheet of mine, everything was available in any of these establishments except for his establishment. Today, all that remains of this notorious street is the Stagecoach Inn, which is Carson's Hotel, and it's now a state park. So all the other facilities are all gone, but John Carson survived and is a state park in Utah. When the Civil War broke out, several years later, the military abandoned their fort, selling a significant portion of the goods to Brigham Young and the Walker brothers, who had become significant merchants, bankers, and mine owners of Utah. They would be counted among the 10 wealthiest men of Utah. Today, two of their residences grace what is now known, or what was known at the time, as Brigham Street in Salt Lake City. And these two of the four Walker brothers married Carson women, so again, I'm connected up to that line. And their story is very interesting as they became wealthy, and they were the main competition of Brigham Young in the auctions there in Fairfield for the military supplies. And they were the second largest purchaser of those behind Brigham Young. General Albert Sidney Johnson was reassigned to the Presidio in San Francisco, California. His wife Elizabeth and their three surviving children accompanied him, arriving from New York by ship on January 14, 1861. So after his tour of duty in Utah was completed, he actually went back east and then was reassigned to the West Coast to be the commanding officer of the Western Front, and set sail and came and arrived in California. A mythical Johnston conspiracy has developed through the years that upon taking command of San Francisco, he had traitorous designs against the government he was serving. It has been proffered that he was there to assure that the gold of California for the use of the South should a civil war commence. It was also suggested that he was organizing a contingent of Southerners for such purposes should hostilities break out. And I read a number of accounts where this was alluded to or inferred that he was doing this type of thing, when in fact this is a false set of facts. The Southerners that had Southern sympathies were in Southern California, not in Northern California, so he would not have found a number of individuals that would have supported that had he tried to instigate that. And this is not the case. His loyalty to the U.S. government was never in question as long as he was commissioned officer of the Union forces. In 1860, he had been tendered the command of the Southwest forces. So before he got this assignment, he was actually offered the command of those down in Texas, but he refused as he feared that the succession of Texas, which he considered his adopted state, thus through General Winfield Scott's support, he had received the command of the Pacific. So he actually, this was a second choice command, because Winfield Scott thought that much of Albert Sidney Johnston, but he didn't want to be in Texas and have that issue of the South and the breakaway occurring if he was there. When Johnston became aware of a plot afoot by some secessionists, he took measures to frustrate any such attempts. He had the arms removed from the arsenal at Benicia and placed in the fort on Alcatraz Island. He also informed California's governor, John G. Downey, of the possibility of insurrection and that the arms he had secured were available for the state militia should anything occur. So again, this is supporting that he was not supporting secessionists to do anything to try to take over California. When Texas did succeed, Johnston tendered his resignation from the U.S. Army on April 9, 1861. Unbeknownst to Johnston, General Winfield Scott had thought so highly of him that it was his desire to have Albert Sidney appointed commander of the entire U.S. Army. So as the Civil War was breaking out, they would have selected Johnston to be the commander-in-chief of the military of the Union forces had he stayed with the Union military. But of course he tendered his resignation identifying that he had Southern sympathies, and so he would not accept such appointment. His resignation was accepted May 3, 1861, and interestingly enough, an order for his arrest was issued by Scott on June 3, 1861. So once they knew that he wasn't interested, they knew that they had another problem, and that was that he would be a great commanding general for the Confederacy, and so they issued a warrant for his arrest. Johnston would travel to Los Angeles with his family, arriving on May 2, 1861. He remained there until June 16th, and then he departed for Texas with a group of about 30 sympathizers from Southern California. They ran the gauntlet, passing through Warner's Ranch and then across Arizona and New Mexico to Texas. They were pursued by Union soldiers but were not apprehended. So the Union forces were actually trying to capture his group of men as he headed towards the south, but they never caught him. His wife, Elizabeth Johnston, would acquire some acreage through her brother John Griffin. John Griffin had owned this land, as I had identified earlier, in Pasadena, and he had then sold a parcel of it to Benjamin D. Wilson. And immediately, just right after he sold it to Wilson, Wilson then turned and sold it to Griffin's sister. So I don't know why they went through that deal instead of him selling it directly to his sister, but that's what occurred. Her intent was to wait out the Civil War in California while her husband served the Confederates' cause with his comrades in arms. She would have a house built on it, this property she acquired, and name the ranch Fair Oaks. Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, had a long friendship and respect for Albert Sidney Johnston. Johnston was made a senior commanding general for the Confederacy. He was made second in command of the entire forces and was considered superior to all but General Robert E. Lee, who was third in command. So he actually was over Robert E. Lee at the time of the commencement of the Civil War. And Jefferson Davis actually had initially wanted to appoint Albert Sidney Johnston as his Secretary of War. But because things were happening so fast with the succession, and Johnston didn't get back there in time, so he had to appoint somebody else. So then he appointed him as second commanding officer of the military, and in fact he was a senior commanding officer out in the field. The one that individual general that was higher than him was in a desk job and actually never went out to see battle or duty in that regard. Elizabeth would remain in Pasadena to wait out her husband's military duties, as she had so often done in the past, but she would never see him alive again. On the morning of the day he died, he told the officers under his command, "We must this day conquer or perish." General Johnston was killed by a ball in the leg as he commanded the Battle of Shiloh on April 6, 1862, while he rode his horse Fire Eater. His body was taken to the St. Louis Cemetery in New Orleans, and a statue of him and his faithful horse now stand in the military cemetery of New Orleans. Cemetery. In 1867, his body was removed and reinterred at the Texas State Cemetery in Austin, Texas, as requested by the Texas legislature. His pallbearers all being generals. There was Beauregard, Bragg, Hood, Buckner, Longstreet, Gibson, Taylor, and Hayes. The U.S. Army was so concerned over this planned service in Galveston for the Confederates that Generals Charles Griffin and Philip Sheridan issued orders forbidding this procession. The people defied it and turned out to stand in silence as his hearse passed through the community. In Houston and again in Austin, he laid in state, and the community honored the hero of the South. So Texas really considered Albert Sidney Johnston as their favorite son in terms of the honors that they wanted to accord him. And in 1900, a marble monument representing him on the battlefield at the moment of his death was placed over his grave. I'm sure that the general's death was as he had visioned an honorable warrior's death should be. And it's interesting that his death should really not have ever occurred. He took a ball in the lower calf of his leg, and he didn't realize that he was mortally wounded. He just thought he had been winged, but it severed an artery, suddenly he became faint, and it was his boot was filling up with blood, and he collapsed. And he had sent, and again, this is the type of man that Albert Sidney Johnson was, he had sent his own physician away from him to assist those captured Union soldiers that were injured. And he had told his men that this is what he wanted, that we should save these men. So he was a very honorable man. Jefferson Davis was devastated by the death of Albert Sidney Johnson. He stated it was the greatest loss the South could have ever suffered. As a result, he appointed Albert Sidney's son as his personal aide-de-camp in April 1862. And he became sort of the surrogate father and was treated like an adopted son. From then on, through the rest of the war, this aide, Albert Sidney Johnson's son, was the favorite companion of Jefferson Davis. He had four aides that served him, but Johnston was always with him. No matter where they went, he relied on him foremost on anything. And in fact, he was with Jefferson Davis when they were captured by Union soldiers. And they maintained this friendship, not only, of course, during the Civil War, but after Davison was released from prison, they continued this friendship between the two families the balance of their lives. And Johnston would go over and assist him and give him help writing his memoirs. And if Jefferson Davis had a problem with one of his sons, he would ask Albert Sidney's sons to assist him to help take care of the problems. And, of course, William Preston Johnson would also become a faculty member of Washington College. So he became himself a very prominent individual. It's interesting to sidelight to genealogy history, of course, as I mentioned earlier, that Jefferson Davis actually had married the daughter of a U.S. president. Unfortunately, she died about 3 years after, or 3 months after their marriage, so it wasn't a long-lived marriage, but it was, she's just suddenly contacted fever that occurred in those days. The death of her husband, Albert Sidney Johnson, naturally was devastating to his wife, Elizabeth. A year later, when Albert Sidney Johnson Jr. was killed in the steamship explosion, she felt she couldn't remain in Pasadena residence any longer, and she sold it to Benjamin Smith Eaton, Sr., who is acknowledged as one of the founders of Pasadena. She went to live with her brother, Dr. John S. Griffin, in Los Angeles. It is very likely that had he not been killed in the Civil War, that Albert Sidney Johnson would have returned to Pasadena and lived the balance of his life here. The name of their home, Fair Oaks, graces one of the major streets in Pasadena today. And as you pass by on the freeway, you'll make note of that and connect Albert Sidney Johnson to the city of Pasadena. Benjamin Smith Eaton's son, Fred Eaton, would also become famous in Los Angeles history. He became a mayor of Los Angeles in 1898, and he was the man behind the idea to get the water from Owens Valley. And he actually took Mulholland up the valley to show him where the water was. Last summer I went up there and went to the city halls in Independence and found where Fred Eaton had acquired all the land rights to all these properties along the river and then sold them back to the city of Los Angeles. He did retain one piece of property that he paid $450,000 of gold pieces for. And he retained this property because he knew that the city of Los Angeles needed a reservoir site. And his intent was to sell it for $1 million. But Mulholland balked at this. And so their long-term friendship for about 30 years suffered. And they didn't have anything to do with each other. Eventually, Los Angeles got that property. And Lake Crowley now is the location of that property that he owned that he wanted to sell for $1 million to the city of Los Angeles. Fred Eaton would marry Helen Lucretia Burdick, the daughter of a Mormon family of Horace Burdick, and a Sarah Catherine Hodge. Obviously, now you see the connection that I connect into this family. Catherine was the daughter of Abraham Kless Hodge, a lifeguard of Joseph Smith, who had resided in Fairfield, Utah at the time of the Johnston Army and when they were encamped there. Albert Sidney Johnson's son, Hancock McClung, would marry Mary Alice Eaton, the daughter of Benjamin Smith Eaton, and Helena Hayes, and the brother of Fred Eaton. Thus, there are more Mormon connections to General Albert Sidney Johnson than is generally known. General Albert Sidney Johnson has returned to Pasadena. Thank you.
I have some very brief comments about the paper, and then I want to make some observations about the time in which Albert Sidney Johnston lived, and then ask some further questions, which probably cannot be answered today, but some questions that I have an interest in. The piece that Lynn Hodge has just given is of the genre of family history. It sketches an outline of Albert Sidney Johnston's life, his extensive family ties and connections, including connections to Pasadena. And for our Sunstone audience who will listen on tape, we are at the Hilton in downtown Pasadena, and four or five blocks west of us is Fair Oaks, which Lynn has just reminded us has this connection with Albert Sidney Johnston and his family. Paraphrasing Barbara Tuchman, the writing of history is a three-part process: the collecting of source material, the interpreting of that material, and the written product. Brother Hodge is a tax accountant who has been very busy lately, and his paper does not have footnotes, and thus it's hard for me to evaluate either the sources or the interpretation of the sources. So one of the suggestions I'd make, and I think he probably already has in mind to do it, is that it would be very helpful for his future readers to add footnotes so that they do not have to reinvent the wheel, and they can actually take his sources and go from there. I'm going to make a couple of comments about the spirit of our age and try and make some comments about the spirit of the age in which Albert Sidney Johnston lived. Some people say that in the United States we have a civil religion, and that civil religion basically comes to us through our Constitution, our system of governments, our Bill of Rights, all of which we unconsciously adopt, and it becomes a civil religion for us. We're all familiar with the phrase, all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these our life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that is part of our civil religion, as well as the freedoms, to name those that are in the First Amendment, of speech, press, association, and the freedom of religion. And yet when we go backwards, we sometimes think, let me stop here. So in our age, at least for most of us, that is part of, it's an unconscious part of us, and we accept the idea that other people have rights, and that we have a tolerance both for their rights and their views and their right of speech and their right of religion and their right to press and so forth. As we project backwards in time, we sometimes think that an earlier age has the same spirit of their age that we do. And yet, that, as we look back in American history, as we look at particularly, I'm going to focus on the 19th century, and as we look back and we look at the experience of African Americans, Native Americans, and since we're here in California, the Chinese in California during the 19th century, and in particular the Native Americans of California in the 19th century after the gold rush. They were not accorded any degree of the kinds of rights and respect and tolerance that, judging by our own age, we think and feel that they should have been. Let me make a comment about religion. In the 19th century's American self-perception was that the American nation was a Protestant nation. They spoke of being a Christian nation, but what they meant by that was it was a Protestant nation. So for immigrants and upstarts, And I guess Mormons actually are included in both categories, as immigrants and upstarts, beginning as upstarts here and then bringing in just a ton of immigrants. But besides the Mormons, the Irish Catholic, the Italian Americans, also Catholic, the Polish Americans, the Mexican Americans, the Hispanics, the Jews, and to bring it up to our modern time, and bring it up to post 9/11, Arab Americans, and then of course among the upstart groups we have the Jehovah Witness, and a prime example is Mormonism. And for those groups who came to or were in this nation, which nominally had various protections of rights, including freedom of religion, the sense you get is that the tolerance that existed within the country was a tolerance for the various varieties of the Protestant religion, and that a lesser degree of tolerance extended to the Catholics, the Mormons, the Jehovah Witness, the Jews, and some others that we could name. Southern ethos that produced what I can only describe as intolerance. Okay, so that's item number three, North versus South. Item number four is the Civil War period itself, and the period before and leading up to the Civil War. It was a very belligerent and bellicose period. They were itching for a fight. It's illustrated by the happening of the Utah War. It's illustrated by the fact that in response to this report of insurrection, not really very well grounded, not really very well justified, the president sends not a peace commission, which he later sent about 9 months later, but he sends an army to accompany the new governor. There's something going on in that period, which I think there's a connection between the attitude that produces the Utah War and the attitude out of which the Civil War arises. Here's a further example of Brevet Major Carleton, who in 1859, he was one of those that investigated the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and of course he wasn't particularly enamored of the Mormons, and probably had good cause because of what he saw. Yet he expresses the idea that he would like to take the sword to the Mormon, and unless somebody thought that that was figurative, he goes on to say that he did not mean it figuratively. He wanted to take the sword to the Mormons. Now, let's go back to Albert Sidney Johnston, who was a Southerner and who was a Protestant. And given what we have seen, what I've sketched for you about those that have a favored status in the United States. Those with a favored status were white men and Protestant. Those who had a lesser status within the United States, and somebody may argue that these are overgeneralizations, but I think they're pretty fair generalizations, were those that had a lesser status or a disfavored status were the non-white, the non-Protestant, not just Mormons, but also Catholic, Jews, and so forth. And who did I leave out? Oh, and women. We also see that in that age, there were limits on both religious tolerance for religions, different religions, and political tolerance for your political ideas about slave, non-slave, and so forth. And so where I leave this is with basically some questions about Albert Sidney Johnston, and given the spirit of his age, questions that I I cannot answer, but just raise because they're interesting to me, is given the fact that he was a Southerner, and did he have this same Southern ethos? What was his degree of political tolerance? What was his degree of religious tolerance? What in particular was his attitude toward the Mormons and so forth? So thank you very much.
Well, as a teacher of history, I found both the presentation. I was here for your presentation earlier on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and then, you know, kind of continuity here between the two presentations. But you mentioned the attitude of the. I guess I should identify myself. My name's Newell Bringhurst, but. I teach history at College of the Sequoias, and kind of as a footnote, I don't know if you were aware when you did your investigation of the Mountain Meadow Massacre, the Thatcher Party, the people that were in that group were actually headed for my area up around Visalia in Central California. That's one of the things you hear there. Vaguely, they were headed for California, but that's where they were headed. And I've always and kind of as a follow up of what you had to say is their financial situation. The cattle they were driving, because that was a big cattle raising area, and I think more needs to be done in looking at the connections there, the family that were already there, and what their finances were, because there's a whole array of interesting questions there. But as far as your presentation on Albert Sidney Johnson, I would just kind of amplify or echo your query about. What were Johnson's attitudes toward the Mormons? You made some allusions. Had he had some contact earlier? Had he had some interaction? I came in a little bit late, and you might have mentioned that in at the beginning of your paper. And I think that would be a fascinating area of inquiry, because you talk about the connections, the family connections with in your own family and everything else subsequent to that. But I'd be interested in knowing. What kind of interactions, interconnections existed between Johnson. Johnson was such a fascinating figure, and I think you did a really cogent job of touching upon his greatness, his fantastic abilities as a general, because Civil War historians have often said that the outcome of the Civil War could have been much different, it would have been much more problematic had Johnston not been killed at the Battle of Shiloh. And then just one other comment, I don't want to monopolize this, is that you were mentioning that there was a connection between sort of the mindset, the attitudes of sending the army out to Utah, in your comments, and the mindset of kind of this hostile attitude going into the Civil War itself. Actually, from my investigation of the topic, I found that one of the reasons that Buchanan, who was sympathetic toward, he was a Northerner, but yet he was very sympathetic toward the South. The reason that Buchanan actually sent the army out there was to try to detract or deflect attention from the rising sectional controversy. I discussed this a little bit in my biography on Brigham Young, that there was this feeling that if we can unify the nation behind a crusade against these awful Mormons out in Utah, then maybe we can deflect attention from the divisions over slavery that are ripping the country apart. Because, the Mormons, sort of like Islam a little bit today, really America's popular whipping boy at the beginning of the American Civil War. I just thought I don't know if that's what you were alluding to, but this is really a crusade to try, a kind of a crude attempt on the part of Buchanan, who I consider one of our absolutely worst presidents. I consider him, if I were ranking presidents in my Bringhurst Hall of Shame, I would probably rank him close to last, because the guy was in many ways, just morally bankrupt. In fact, Brigham Young said, made reference, he was a bachelor, made reference how he liked to visit the various bordellos of Washington, D.C. to gratify his sexual things, you know, and he was actually in many ways a politically, morally bankrupt individual. And I think that had a lot to do with what, you know, kind of a cynical ploy. But anyway, I've said too much. I've said enough.
Actually, now I have that same kind of a question. I was wondering if you read, because it sounds to me as if you dealt with a lot of primary documents there. Did you read any journals of Johnson's that where he did talk about his reactions to living there? I mean, I didn't realize he had stayed there, as you mentioned, you know, for a couple of years before his next assignment. And did he talk about the, you know, living there among the Mormons or anything?
Okay, I didn't come across anything in my...
Can you repeat the question?
Okay, the question was, did Albert Sidney Johnson have any reaction to living among the Mormons and so forth that he wrote about? And I didn't come across any material. First of all, he was a Southerner. He had adopted Texas as his adoptive state. He was not a native Texan. He did not come from a plantation environment himself. His wife had pressed him to try and become a plantation owner. He didn't want any part of it. So he was not a large slave owner. And he did not get himself involved with slavery that much. He had a manservant, this one that stole from him, who accompanied him on his military campaigns. But he did not have a number of slaves that he transferred or sold and dealt with. As far as the Mormons are concerned, I found that there's a scarcity of books written about Albert Sidney Johnson. But I did, fortunately, come across the book that was written by his son that survived him, that was aide-de-camp of Davis.
No.
It's Preston. And in there, he does not go into describing Mormons that much, even though that was a part of his military campaigns. He does not describe his father's attitude towards the Mormons at all. I got the gist that he didn't probably care for Brigham Young too much, but there was not a lot expressed about his feelings of Mormons. And in all of his prior military campaigns, I mean, he was down in Texas fighting the Mexicans and the Indians in Oklahoma, and so he did not have an involvement of being around the Mormons up in Missouri or Illinois so that he would be involved in that issue at that time.
He wouldn't have been around in Utah because most of the Mormons were
North. And of course, he stayed right on his military base there outside of Fairfield and didn't leave that general area taking excursions into the Utah territory at all.
You know, in reflecting back on this experience in Utah, did he have any observations or reflections upon that time that he spent out in Utah? You know, looking back in retrospect.
Yeah. I'm sure he had feelings. I just did not come across any of the material that alluded to what his response was in that regard.
It may have been by what he didn't say, too. Maybe he was just so dang focused on what he was doing,
yeah,
he didn't even notice where he was.
And see, originally, there was another general that was ordered to go to Utah, and he was displaced by Albert Sidney Johnson because the government felt that Albert was a more competent general and wanted him to lead the excursion of this military force. I know that he was very upset when he, of course, had to deal with the raiding of the wagons and so forth and his encampment during the winter, and that created an attitude, and I got that in the writings, that there was a hostility created because of the environment that they all had to exist during that winter. And so his idea was to go down and whip a little rear end down there in Utah because it was payback time. I mean, they had endured starvation, and they had lost a lot of their animals up there in Wyoming, and they wanted to go down, and it was only through the other parties that deferred that. And it was fortunate, I think, for us that it was, because if he had been given a free rein to just go down there, many of the Mormons could have been wiped out. We really don't know.
Thank you very much. Yeah, if you want to stay and visit with him, I know you can. Thanks.